will now hear arguments in Trevino versus Ortega and Malone versus Foster.
May it please the court. Mr. Brent Cooper and Ms. Joanne Wilkins will present arguments for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Cooper will open with the first 12 minutes. Mr. Cooper will also present the rebuttal.
May it please the court. The issue in this case is whether or not Texas should recognize an independent court for spoliation of evidence, or whether or not the remedies that we have had in place traditionally are adequate to protect the rights of litigants in our courts. No Texas court before this case, the Ortega case, had recognized such a duty. In fact, the few cases, one or two cases before, albeit dicta, had declined to recognize an independent tort, relying, in fact, upon the presumptions and other common law and statutory precautions that were in place. Texas in the past has followed the majority of jurisdictions across the states which refused to recognize the independent tort of spoliation, and we are urging this court to continue to follow the majority of the courts across the country. My client was originally sued for medical malpractice. After the malpractice suit was brought, it was discovered that the records, which had been put in a warehouse some 12 or 14 years earlier, were missing. Thereafter, the spoliation suit was filed, and one of the primary causes, or the primary cause in this action against my client, is for spoliation. Now, it's our position that there is no need for this court to create a new tort where you have adequate remedies already in place. This court last October, in the case of Maryland Insurance Company versus Head, was urged to expand the remedies available against third-party liability insurance. And this court looked at the existing law and said that there were safeguards already that were in place to protect the rights of the litigants and refused to expand and create new causes of action where none were needed. We believe the same situation exists in this case. We believe there are at least three safeguards that are already in place that more than adequately protect the rights of litigants dealing with spoliation. First and foremost is the presumption that this court has recognized and that other courts have recognized for a party who destroys or conceals evidence. And basically, if it is shown, then a party is entitled to an instruction to the jury that the evidence which has been destroyed would have been unfavorable to the spoliator and would have aided the plaintiff, assuming the plaintiff was not the spoliator. Furthermore, the courts have said that where there is spoliation, that the presumption, when unrebutted, establishes a fact. That is, it creates what is known as artificial evidence, enough evidence to survive a summary judgment, evidence to survive a motion for direct verdict, evidence to survive a motion for new trial, and evidence to sustain a sufficiency, either legal or factual sufficiency challenge on appeal. So you have all of this evidence of these presumptions that exist where there is spoliation. You look at the evidence in this case, is what we have. If you look at page 16 of the brief, the plaintiffs in this case list what evidence they had. They knew that the child was born. They knew that at the time the child was born, the child weighed 5,060 grams. They knew, and they're going to say that by some methods of delivery, babies weighing greater than 4,000 grams sustained shoulder dystocia in 23% of the cases. They also knew the baby was not delivered by cesarean, but was a vaginal delivery. You have this evidence. You have the presumption that whatever was in the medical records would favor the plaintiffs in this case. We believe that this is adequate to protect the plaintiffs and that creating of some additional independent tort is not needed.
In this case, what instructions should be given to the jury?
If in fact, and again we would refer the court to the Dowling, Brewer versus Dowling case, if the court found that there was intentional destruction, which again is an issue which has not been addressed yet, which we don't believe is the case, we believe that it will show that it was put in the warehouse, and the warehouse simply misplaced or lost it. But if it is shown that it is an intentional destruction, then the jury is to be instructed that there is a presumption that the evidence which was lost, which was destroyed, was unfavorable to the cause of the spoliator and would aid the case of the plaintiff.
What if it wasn't intentional? You've got a statutory duty to maintain the records. You don't. What if they weren't intentionally destroyed? What then? What do you do? What instruction did the jury receive in that?
Well, of course, in the Dowling case, the court said that the spoliation instruction only went to cases where there was intentional spoliation, that if it was accidental, if they were merely lost through no culpability on the part of the defendant, in that case the hospital, then there would be no instruction.
What happens when the records are lost due to the negligence of one of the parties?
Well, of course, that's one of the issues that this court is going to have to address and was not addressed by the Court of Appeals, and that is whether or not negligence in losing a record will give rise to this presumption as opposed to intention. We believe, again, if there has been good faith effort to comply with the statute and there has been no negligence, then the instruction clearly should not be given. The question is whether or not if there was negligence, if there was a duty to
assuming
there was a duty, and then I think the position would be that probably there should be some instruction.
So what would the instruction be?
The instruction again would be, I think, to a lesser standard, but would say that there is some presumption that the evidence that would have been contained in the record, again, if it's not unrebutted, presumption is not unrebutted, would be that it would be unfavorable to the cause of the spoliation. Now, we believe also that in addition to the presumptions that have, this court is well familiar that there are pretrial sanctions that are available if a party destroys a document during the pretrial process after litigation or after there has been, for example, in a medical malpractice case, after a 4590I letter has been sent. And in fact, there are cases we've cited in our brief, the San Antonio Press versus Kelstonville Machinery case, where pretrial sanctions were utilized as an alternative to the presumption, evidentiary presumption, given by the trial court. There were also, has been pointed out by at least two courts of appeals, the Malone Court from Dallas, and by, in fact, the Ortega Court, that you have penal statutes. Section 37.02 of the Penal Code specifically makes it a crime to commit an offense if they alter or destroy a document in connection with an official proceeding. And both of those courts held that, at least implicitly, that a civil trial was an official proceeding such that if there was a destruction of evidence, it would give rise to a violation of Section 37.
If what you're saying is it could be a crime.
It could be a crime.
But for the person who is injured in court trying to sue, the fact that the person they're suing may be put in jail for it doesn't resolve the tort issue.
No, it doesn't. And that's why you have the presumption to aid the person, whether it be the plaintiff or the defendant, who is the victim of the spoliation by the other side. Now, the plaintiff's proposal, and I think it is very important for the court to focus on, but the Court of Appeals announced a totally different rule or standard than the plaintiffs are proposing before this court. What the Court of Appeals said was that if we're going to recognize this independent tort, that you're going to have to show that but for the loss of the evidence, the plaintiff would have prevailed. Sort of like a legal malpractice case, a suit within a suit. In fact, the Court of Appeals said the opportunity to prevail in a civil action is what is being compensated. If you look, however, at what the plaintiffs are asking this court to do on page 17 of their reply brief, they're not asking the court to adopt that standard. What they're asking this court to do is to hold that if four things are shown, they're entitled to recover. One is that there was a duty to maintain the records and there was a breach. Two is there's an absence of the records which has impaired their ability to present the case. And if you can show that the absence of the records has impaired their ability to present their case, they're asking this court then to say there is a presumption they would have won. The jury's not asked would they have won but for the absence of the records? If they show that, they're asking this court to say if the absence of the records impairs their ability to present the case, then presumption they would have prevailed in the underlying case and then damages. Now, what the plaintiff would have won, well, basically what concern we have...
Well, let me just clarify, if I can, because
sure.
Let's say that we don't find that.
Okay.
We don't create that cause of action. What would then happen is that you would have a trial on the merits of the underlying matter, and there would be this instruction go to the jury that submits to the jury that same presumption.
Correct. If the presumption is unrebutted.
If the presumption what?
Is unrebutted. It's a rebuttable presumption, which the courts, if you look at the HEB Butt grocery case, if you look at the Brewer versus Dowling case, talk about the fact in certain cases, if the defendant, for example, in the Dowling case, it was a lost fetal monitoring strip. And the hospital came back and showed two things. One is they showed that it was not intentionally destroyed, that it was accident. Second, they showed through the doctor's and the nurse's testimony that the information on the monitoring strip, in fact, would have been favorable to the hospital and not contrary to their interests. And the Fort Worth Court of Appeals, in that case, which was appealed here and writ was denied in 1993, held that in that case, that the parties had rebutted the inference. And in fact, there was no entitlement on the part of the plaintiff to that instruction, and the instruction was refused. And in fact, that was one of the holdings of the court, and that was brought to this court through application for writ of error and was denied. The concern we have, and I'm bad out of time, is whether or not, if you adopt something like this, we're going to get back to not trying cases on the merits, but trying cases through discovery, trying to find a document's lost, so then you can get this presumption they're asking for that they would have won. You have weak cases, and instead of, again, trying them on the merits, you're trying them on discovery. And we all know in the late 80s, when we had all the discovery rules and discovery battles and death penalty sanctions, that a lot of cases were not tried on the merits, but were tried on discovery. And there were a lot of abuses. I will go ahead.
It's a separate case. I think we better hear.
I will go ahead and say thank you.
Good morning. I do represent Drs. Fosters and Christensen and Baylor University Medical Center. This case is a little different from the Ortega case. It is a medical malpractice case against the doctors and the nurses for which they sought to hold Baylor vicariously liable. And it included a spoliation claim. However, on appeal, we are limited to looking at the intentional tort of spoliation. This case doesn't involve medical records. It involves an incident report. And it's about an intentional destruction based on a business decision, but not a destruction with the intent to disrupt or destroy plaintiff's ability to prove a case. Moreover, it involves a destruction by a party against whom a claim was not being tried to the jury. In other words, the issue that the jury was deciding was whether the doctors or nurses were negligent, and they did not, it is undisputed, have anything to do with the destruction of the incident report that was pursuant to Baylor's policy.
Tell me why that doesn't make your case, in fact, a little bit more difficult. And let me just kind of use this scenario, which is almost the one you painted, and that is you have a case where plaintiff sues defendant. And defendant doesn't have any control over documents that are key to the case. Well, you have a third party who, let's say, is in league with the defendant in one way or another. No type of conspiracy or anything like that. But this third party wouldn't mind at all making sure that the defendant is exonerated. And for whatever reason, it's this third party that's responsible for maintaining documents that are going to be absolutely essential for the prosecution of the case. And that third party just decides that they are going to go ahead and intentionally destroy those documents. And that totally undermines the case of the plaintiff. Now, in that particular case, a spoliation charge, it seems to me, would not be acceptable, because there was no destruction by the documents by the defendant. So what remedy does the plaintiff have?
Well, from your question and the facts that you stated, the third party that has spoliated them was aware of the claim that was going to be made. And you have a criminal statute that addresses that, although there's 9Ks I could find that applies it to civil actions. I think that it is appropriate to be considered, because when there is an investigation, doesn't have to be a proceeding, going on, then it can be a crime to destroy evidence with the intent to hinder that. And I think that addresses that particular scenario.
Well, that addresses the crime side, but again, does nothing for the tort victim.
Well, I think you will have to fashion a remedy in that kind of situation, keeping in mind, however, that not every harm or alleged harm deserves redress or can actually be redressed, because there isn't a common law duty to preserve records. And indeed, the third party undeniably has a right to deal with its own records as it sees fit when there's not a duty. In fact, this court in the Texas beef cattle case, it would be a strange doctrine indeed if one with a right to deal with the property could be held liable for doing that.
Are you then implying that if there were a statutory duty to maintain those records, then an independent cause of action in tort would lie against the party responsible for maintaining those records for their destruction of those records?
If there is a statutory duty to maintain the records, there is a duty, and that is the basis for compensating a loss sustained by a wrongdoer. Before you can have a wrongdoer, you have to have a duty. If you have the duty, then the breach, there's no need to create another tort, because you already have those principles. Those are the rationales expressed by the courts that have addressed the tort of spoliation. Some of them have actually found the principles that are already in place. If there is a duty, in fact, a breach of that duty may very well result in a remedy having to be fashioned for any harm that is that occurs. But I think the court needs to keep in mind that a tort of spoliation is going to impose some burdens that have to be considered. As I said, you do have a right to deal with your own property as you see fit. But if a tort of spoliation is adopted, then you're going to be making decisions about what to do with your records based on somebody else's interest instead of your own. You're going to have to be making decisions about relevancy of these documents to some unknown claim. And most businesses and people are not going to try to do that. They're just going to keep everything. And that has a cost, too. And if they try to make a decision, what if they make a decision the Senate disagrees with? Are they then liable in that case? And I think one of the biggest things the court needs to keep in mind is that this tort is going to expose people to suits and liability for injuries that they didn't cause, and upon a lesser burden than the plaintiff had against the original tortfeasor. You can be creating something that's going to be better than the real thing. The Malone case is not even a case that's appropriate for consideration of whether there should be an intentional tort of spoliation. There's not a duty in this case. These are not medical records, so you can't make the argument that perhaps Section 241-103 of the Health and Safety Code creates some kind of duty. There's certainly no culpable intent in this case. I think that the other elements that have been recognized in that tort are equally lacking here, such as the intent and causation. And certainly the court must keep in mind the relevancy of the documents to the claims that are actually being tried.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from Ms. Fong.
May it please the court. Mr. Charles McGarry and Mr. Randall Jackson will present argument for respondents. Mr. McGarry, welcome for the first 12 minutes.
May it please the court. First, let it be perfectly clear that the state of Texas has an extremely strong public policy against the destruction of evidence. The destruction of evidence in a pending case is not only a crime, it's a third-degree felony. It's not only subject to sanctions, but death penalty sanctions have been upheld. And also, the Amarillo Court of Appeals has previously written that one of the purposes of having statutes of limitation is to advise defendants how long they must preserve evidence. The first question this court must address then is, if there is in fact an extremely strong public policy against destroying evidence, when does the corresponding duty to preserve or not destroy that evidence arise?
How would you specifically have us define the duty? Since you've acknowledged there must be a duty, and I presume that's because if there's going to be a tort, it has to start with a duty.
It has to start with a duty.
And how would you have us define the duty?
Duty not to destroy evidence. Duty to preserve, take reasonable steps to preserve evidence.
Does that presume the pendency of a cause of action?
I suggest that that duty arises whenever litigation is reasonably anticipated. You can adopt the full line of cases from National Tank versus Brotherton when privileges are created in anticipation of litigation. If you can anticipate that a lawsuit's going to be filed, you should not be allowed to destroy evidence that's going to be relevant to that litigation.
Well, then why would there be a duty in the Trevino case, Mr. McGarry?
The statutory duty arises in the Trevino case because there is a statute that requires medical records to be preserved from their inception.
So if in the absence of a statute, party has no reason to anticipate litigation, then there would be no duty and no tort of spoliation.
I would agree. I think the duty arises once a person may reasonably anticipate that there will be litigation.
Do they also have to reasonably anticipate what may be evidence?
No. Well, I think it is a reasonable person standard. If it's a highly debatable relevancy, the spoliation tort is going to have problems in causation. But in the two cases before this court, the documents were essential, and any reasonable person would have known that they were essential.
You've just given us a list of things that can are the consequences of spoliation of evidence in a pending case, including death penalty sanctions. Why aren't those adequate?
There's lots of reasons why they're not adequate. Number one, because they only protect against destruction of evidence in a pending case and not somebody who destroys evidence knowing that a case is going to be filed next week. Secondly...
Wait a second before you go on. For the case that is filed next week, where the records are already destroyed, they could still have an instruction given to the jury in that case, could they not? And why would that not be?
The instruction is an inadequate remedy for several reasons. Number one, first and foremost, because it's a largely unenforceable remedy. Instructions, trial courts have very broad discretion not to submit instructions. And in fact, the trial judge in this case refused to submit a spoliation instruction, refused to even allow the jury to hear the fact that documents were intentionally destroyed.
What would that be, a discretion that can be corrected on appeal?
Several courts of appeals, including Dallas and both Houston courts, have held that the trial court's discretion to refuse an instruction is even broader than the trial court's discretion in how to formulate a jury question. Several courts have also relied upon the language of Rule 277 to say that trial courts have discretion to refuse a jury instruction whenever that trial judge is of the opinion that the jury is capable of rendering a proper verdict without the instruction. One site of a case that holds that is Thomas v. St. Joseph Hospital out of the Houston First, 618 Southwest 2nd, 791. If a party intentionally destroys evidence, knowing that a lawsuit's going to be filed, I think, and argued to the Court of Appeals, and argued in my brief in this court, that even without an instruction, a lot of jurors are going to make a negative inference. He destroyed documents. He must be hiding something. That is an argument that can be made, that even without the instruction, some type of negative inference is going to be drawn. And if that argument can be made, I think it can be made in favor of not submitting the instruction. The jury doesn't need to know that destroying evidence is trying to hide something. They're going to infer that naturally. So I think that in cases of intentional destruction of evidence, there's a ready-made argument in each and every case to justify not submitting an instruction. And the trial courts have discretion not to submit it. Moreover, even if the instruction is given, what if the jury just simply decides to disregard it? How would the parties know? How would the judge know? How would a court of appeals be able to review a jury's disregarding of an instruction?
Why should we presume that a jury would disregard it?
Well, you can't presume one way or the other, but if the jury
the
does...
But the law says we can presume that they follow
that
it.
They presume that they do follow it.
Well, I don't understand.
But
the distinction between submitting an issue to the jury on a foliation cause of action versus an instruction. What if the jury...
Because there's going to be a well-established standard of review based on evidence as to whether or not the evidence supported the jury's answer in finding whether or not the evidence was destroyed. Whether or not the destruction of that evidence proximately caused the loss of a lawsuit.
Mr. McGarry, now you've gone to the second element of what I presume would be your cause of action, and that's causation. And your proposal is that proximate cause would be the causation element in this cause of action. Is that right?
Yes.
All right. How, in one of these cases, would the proof of proximate cause ever rise beyond the level of speculation?
Very easily. Your Honor, the quantum and manner of proof of a spoliation cause of action is going to be identical to that in a legal malpractice case. The element of the cause of action...
But isn't the point, Mr. McGarry, that the reason why you say we need this tort is because the plaintiff cannot prove his or her claim? Now, spoliation could also cut against the plaintiff, I take it, as well. This could
Correct.
Cut both ways. But
Right.
in your scenario, you're arguing on behalf of a plaintiff. Plaintiff can't prove the case. That's why we have to have the tort of spoliation. Otherwise, there's no remedy for the plaintiff. And now you're saying that we're going to be able to go into court and have proof by a preponderance of the evidence that this missing evidence is what caused me not to be able to prove my case.
I have an answer to that.
Okay.
Let me first outline the elements of the cause of action I propose, very simply. The existence of a duty to preserve evidence, the intentional, in the Malone case, the negligent breach of that duty in the Trevino case, proximate causation and damages, just like a legal malpractice case. I disagree with the Ortega court and any other suggestion that the quantum of proof necessary for causation and damages is going to be any lower in a spoliation case. I think you hold it to the full standard of evidence required to prove proximate causation and damages as you would in any other case.
With or without a presumption of the missing?
With evidence. The presumption. The one
why
area of
you,
uncertainty.
Why should you presume that in a spoliation?
Because, and I think the Trevino case is a good example of this, in our case, in the Malone case, we have independent evidence sufficient to reach a jury as to what was in the destroyed document. The facts in our case were that Mr. Malone fell out of bed. He complained that he was paralyzed, that he could not get up. He told the nurse this fact. The nurse's testimony was, I cannot recall what he told me, but whatever it was he told me, I put down in this record that was subsequently destroyed. I think that's sufficient evidence of what was in the record, sufficient to reach a jury. However, in many cases, and the Trevino case is an example of this, there is simply no way to infer the content of the document. Therefore, the presumption must still apply in those cases to shift the burden of proof, not on causation, not on damages, we're not reducing the level of proof not required of those elements, but of the content of the destroyed document, that the presumption should be still that the person who destroyed it because it was adverse to that party.
But that's what you have with the instruction.
Correct.
So how have you changed anything except an additional level of damage?
Well, because, as I said, the instruction is not enforceable. It doesn't have to be given. Number two, it doesn't have to be followed. And number three, the instruction is not always required in every case. There are several cases that interpret Brewer versus Dowling to require that instruction only if there is independent adverse evidence and the party who had, was in possession of the evidence failed to produce it in rebuttal. In other words, there's a corroboration requirement before you even get the instruction. Well, how does that help someone if the defendant destroys all of the evidence on an issue? They destroy all of the evidence on an issue, there's not going to be any corroborative evidence. You don't even get the instruction under Brewer versus Dowling.
Mr. McGarry, then, do I understand you correctly that your evidence of proximate cause is the presumption?
No. No.
Well, what is the evidence?
The presumption
proximate
only
cause
applies
in a case like the Trevino case where we don't know what the record said.
The presumption applies to determine what the record said. Given that presumption, and given if it's not rebutted, it's still a rebuttable presumption. Given that presumption of what the record says, the plaintiff still must prove that if we had the record and if it did say this adverse stuff, we would have won the case. They still have to prove the causation. The same, let me draw the analogy again to a legal malpractice case. Suppose the legal malpractice is that the attorney failed to designate an expert witness. You're missing evidence. You're being deprived of evidence. The case against the lawyer, you have to prove the content of that missing evidence. And if it's destroyed, obviously you need the presumption, but if it's not destroyed, you have to prove the content. But you separately have to prove that the admission of that content would have made the difference in winning the underlying case. The causation element remains the same, and the plaintiff retains the full burden of proof that given adverse evidence was destroyed, does that adverse evidence make a difference?
But I'm still not sure you've answered Judge Hackett's question.
Excuse me?
I'm still not sure you've answered Judge Hackett's question, because it seems that you are compressing and subsuming the proximate cause into the presumption.
Well, the content obviously is going to be relevant to proximate cause.
I mean, if you say what you're saying, that the proximate cause issue is the same as you would have to prove in a medical malpractice case, based on the type of claim we have here, how do you prove that under your theory?
Well, suppose, for example, you have in the Trevino case the missing documents presumed to support the plaintiff's expert's opinion. You still have to go through with the rest of the trial to prove that, okay, I've got this expert opinion based on presumed adverse evidence. Is that enough to win the case? You still have to prove proximate causation, that you would have won the case.
So I'm sorry.
You have to prove the medical malpractice case.
You have to prove the medical malpractice
within
case.
Within the framework of the spoliation.
Excuse me. I didn't hear you.
Within the framework of the spoliation tort cause of action.
It's a case within a case, just like a legal malpractice case.
In Trevino, there's a separate lawsuit, which is the one that's here, purely on spoliation as a tort. There's a pending malpractice case that hasn't been tried yet.
Is the expert witness then base her opinions on the presumption?
In the Trevino case,
so we would have a doctor get on the witness and say, I'm going to presume that these medical records show that the doctor was negligent. And they're also going to show that the doctor's negligence was the proximate cause of the harm to the plaintiff. What is the expert witness in this case within a case going to base his or her opinions on?
The only presumption is the content of the document. There's no presumption regarding negligence, no presumption regarding proximate causation or damages.
But the
presumption is, here's a fetal monitor strip and it's going to show this data. That's the presumption. The experts come and say, given that data, it's my opinion, there's negligence. And then the plaintiff has to prove that given that opinion, now that we have that presumed adverse evidence, that was proximate cause.
But
that would have won the suit.
The presumption is that the evidence is adverse, not that the missing evidence contains particular information. For example, the expert's not going to get to say as part of the presumption, I get to presume that this fetal heart monitor strip showed deceleration that that the staff at the hospital did not take care of.
That point is an equal argument against the instruction, because the instruction is so vague. How adverse do we presume the evidence is? In what manner do we presume it's adverse? However, in both the cases in front of this court today, the choice is A or B. It's either he said that he was paralyzed or he didn't say he was paralyzed. The fetal monitor showed distress or it didn't show distress. It's going to be one or the other. And so by merely presuming adversity, you're going to be choosing choice B instead of choice A.
Earlier you mentioned, Judge Hankinson, that yes, this tort, if created, would also cut and could cut against the plaintiff and can be raised by the defendant. How does a defendant get the benefit of the tort if it's created?
Be a counterclaim. My defensive evidence been destroyed by the plaintiff?
For what? What
basically, it would be an offset. Evidence? It would be any liability I incur in this case is due to the fact the plaintiff destroyed my defensive evidence, and my damages are exactly equal to whatever he'd be able to prove and be an equal offset. It'd be a defense.
An affirmative defense.
Affirmative.
I'm not meaning that they would just, the plaintiff wouldn't recover anything if it's an affirmative defense.
Correct.
Rather than an affirmative counterclaim for damage.
Well, it's a counterclaim for exactly the offset, most likely, because the damages of the defendant would be whatever liability incurred.
So is it your view then that the damages in this type of court is exactly the same damages that you recover in the medical malpractice case?
In both these cases, yes. The California courts have recognized that the spoliation tort might also be applicable in merely making a case more expensive to prove. We needed extra experts, or we had to recreate this expensive evidence, blah, blah, blah. They go a little farther and say that the damages might not be the same, but in these cases, largely, they are going to be exactly the same. It's going to be just like a legal malpractice suit. My time is up, and we do have co-counsel. I do request the leave of the court. I was just served with a response to my application this morning, and I do request leave of the court to reply in a brief 2 or 3 page memorandum.
May it please the court. Of one thing there can be no question in this case, and that is without the existence of the independent cause of action, there will be no remedy for Linda Ortega. She cannot get to the jury. She cannot get to the jury with a penal code provision. She cannot get to the jury with a presumption. And she cannot get to the jury with a pretrial sanction. That is because she was afflicted by an honest expert, an expert that in all truth and honesty said, I have no records to review. I know what happened to the girl. I know she has an Erb's palsy as the result of a shoulder dystocia. I know that she was born weighing 11.2 pounds. I know how it happened. I can't tell you why. Because the entire medical chart is gone. All the prenatal record is gone. All the delivery record is gone. Without something to review, the honest expert who was honestly presented said, I cannot tell you by a standard of reasonable medical probability what caused this injury. And if this court reverses Corpus Christi Court of Appeals, this case will stand for the proposition that it is better to destroy all of the evidence rather than some of the evidence. This will stand for the proposition that you have a free license to destroy an entire medical.
Well, no, it's not totally free. It is a crime.
It is a crime. If it's done after the case is filed and if they're caught. And in most hospital settings, the circumstances of the storage of the medical records are entirely in the hands of the hospital, as was the case in this case.
Well, but they do have an assertion that the doctor's not the hospital is bound by that retention statute. That's correct. It's a contention by them.
On the duty side?
Well, on the violation of the statute, it doesn't apply to them. So they don't have a duty, statutory duty.
Okay, I understand where the court's going. Hospitals have the statute, Health and Safety Code 241.103. Doctors have the canons of medical ethics. a court would be free to adopt the canons of ethics as promulgated by the Texas Medical Association and the Medical Association, and we have them reproduced in our brief. A court could adopt those as establishing duty. I think it would be preposterous among the medical community if you lined up 100 doctors and say, doctor, does or does not a doctor have a duty to maintain medical records to care for your patients?
This is a distinction of strict liability cause of action. If you lose the records, you're liable. And that's essentially what this falls down to.
Yes.
Well, then you disagree with Mr. McGarry that you'd have to prove a medical malpractice case with an exfoliation claim in order to prevail?
I'm saying that you would have to have enough proof by expert testimony, as we do in this case, to say, I know what happened. I, the expert, testifying to the jury, I know what the injury is. I know what caused it. What I can't tell you is, by standard of reasonable medical probability, exactly how it happened.
Well, but Mr. McGarry says that you have to prove the medical malpractice case within the spoliation case, which I presume would require those same opinions to be offered, the opinions based on reasonable medical probability. Correct? Do you agree with that?
I do not agree entirely with Mr. McGarry's presentation of the Ortega case. I believe that through expert medical testimony, you would have to establish the circumstances of an injury. You would have to establish the cause of the injury. The question in the Ortega case is what of a number of factors gave rise to the causation of the injury.
And we don't know that because we don't have the records.
We can never know that because
right.
we don't have
so
the records.
So let me ask you the same question I asked Mr. McGarry. Why would your proof of causation in the spoliation case amount to nothing more than speculation?
Because you will be establishing. I'm not going to ask an expert witness to make up facts which could or could not have been contained in the medical record.
Well, are you going to have to prove causation in this tort?
I can.
Are you saying that that's an element of the tort, causation?
In two ways. The loss of the medical records was a proximate cause of the loss of the cause of action. Okay? Second way, second issue of causation. Medical expert will say this injury was caused by this mechanism. And then, if called upon to do so, and in the guidance of the trial court, the medical expert could, in order to assist the jury, say, these are the range of things which can cause this result. But
so we're not rising to the level of proximate cause then?
On one level we are, yes, because the loss of the medical record was a proximate cause of the loss of the medical negligence cause of action.
And that's based on the expert's testimony. I can't offer an opinion without the record?
Yes.
Well, does that mean that you have protected, there's a protected property interest in filing a suit in the state of Texas based on your viewpoint of what the proximate cause issue is in the spoliation tort?
I believe that in this state there has long been recognized a property interest in a present or prospective cause of action, if I'm answering the question.
In this case, did the expert say, I can say it was caused at birth, or did he say it could have been caused at any point in your life, or was there any, could you even pinpoint it at a point in time?
We can absolutely pinpoint it because the child was carried across the street from McGowan Maternity Center and taken to the emergency room at the real hospital on the other side of the road where a chart was opened. At that chart, it was identified by the attending ER physician as an herbs palsy-induced birth injury. So we can establish with absolute precision when it happened.
What if you see the hospital, the doctors, and the nurses, and the records are gone? Are each of them strictly liable for that injury?
Depends on whose record it is. The hospital who had the duty to maintain the chart would be responsible. And if it was a doctor's chart that was lost, then the doctor would be responsible. But no, not everybody in the chain.
So that makes the hospital the insurer of the nurse or doctor's negligence.
It makes the hospital charged with the duty which it has under statute to maintain the records and responsible for the consequences if they breach their statutory duty.
But there's no consequence under the statute of what happens to you if you breach it.
Therefore, it's an empty statute, and therefore this court needs to afford some enforcement mechanism by recognition of this cause of action.
What if there's some injury that manifests itself later in a child's life, and there are various things that could have caused it, and you go back to two or three treating physicians, none of whom have records? Do you presume that each of them was negligent in treating the child?
Over an extended period of time, measured in years?
Let's say a child was given some sort of drug that manifests an adverse reaction a couple of years later, and you go back to three different physicians, and you treated the child, none of whom had the drug. You presume that each of them gave the child the drug?
I would not, but...
How do you check?
But the court has cast it in terms of a drug was administered. Somebody knows that the drug was administered. That exists in a record someplace. And you know who administered it by virtue of the pharmacy records.
We'll say it wasn't a drug. Some treatment.
A procedure.
It could have been one of three different physicians. And none of the records 15 years later are available. How do you parse it out in that
Summers v. Tice crossed with a spoliation claim? Your Honor, in all honesty, I believe that would be stretching the cause of action a bit too far. And I think that that would be a situation in which it would be subject to summary judgment by virtue of a defendant expert saying, we can't tell.
Why would that case be different than at the child's birth where it could have been the nurse, it could have been the anesthetist, it could have been the physician?
It doesn't matter. All three of them were working from a McAllen maternity clinic.
Or the hospital. Well, the doctor. No.
The doctor was an employee of the McAllen maternity.
That's a whole different issue we'll have to address. But why pick, do you pick just the hospital and say, well, it was their records, but they're the one who picked?
Because they're the one charged with the statutory duty to keep them. If it was a physician, it would be a physician that I would urge charged with an ethical duty to keep the records. And if he did not reasonably do so, then in that event, he would be liable. And remember what I'm asking the court. I'm asking the court to approve a cause of action whereby the jury would be asked, did the loss of the records materially impair the plaintiff's ability to bring the cause of action? It's not a strict liability concept, in all due respect. It is a reasonableness statute. And if the jury says, yeah, losing these documents, losing these records, whatever they are, was such a blow to the plaintiff's ability to bring the cause of action that they effectively couldn't do it.
Why would that be a yes answer every time? Slam dunk.
For example, in Brewer versus Downey, the mere loss of the fetal monitor strip, I think the Court of Appeals was probably correct in that case. I think there was other evidence of what fetal monitor strip showed that it was immaterial.
Does that put the defendant in a position, though, of having to come up and present to the jury a whole bunch of evidence of why you could otherwise won the case?
It could do, but it's not significantly different from what we have now. It merely makes it a different claim.
But in that case, the Downey case, it was a question of law for the court about materiality. You're saying now we submit it to the jury and to this jury.
In a spoliation cause of action, yes.
But the Downey court might not have been able to reach the issue the way it did under a spoliation cause of action.
The jury would have been asked in the Downey case, do you find by preponderance of the evidence that the fetal monitoring strip was material and that the loss of this material evidence was such that it rendered the plaintiff incapable of presenting his cause of action?
Did they say yes? Court of Appeals would say no.
Then that's what our courts are for, and that's what juries are for.
Well, if there's some evidence, again, if we presume the fetal monitor is adverse, okay, even though there's a lot of evidence that it wouldn't be, under your theory, the jury still gets to say yes, it was adverse.
I'm not heaping a presumption on top of a cause of action. Okay? I think it is implicit in the concept of a spoliation cause of action that you are saying the material would be adverse. I think that's inherent. You're not then again telling the jury you are to presume it was adverse. You're asking the jury, was it material?
My point is, under the Downey case, the Court of Appeals can look at all the evidence and say, we will not presume it was adverse because all of the other evidence says it's not. Under your theory, you automatically, in a spoliation case, assume the jury is entitled to draw the conclusion that it was adverse, even if the evidence, all the other evidence says no.
I would not give that charge. I would not instruct the jury, you are to presume the evidence would be adverse.
But if they, my point is, it wouldn't be, they're asked the question, was it material? If they find it was material, even though there's no other evidence other than the fact that it was lost, that finding would stand under your theory, would it not?
But it's going to be a fact specific, it's going to be a fact-sensitive inquiry in each case. The jury would be told the importance of the fetal monitoring strip, that there is a dispute regarding its contents, that two doctors and a nurse would testify to what they saw on it, that there is no, that there is other evidence correlating in the case that the infant was not in fetal distress at the relevant time, and then the jury would be asked, was it material, and did it destroy the plaintiff's ability to bring the cause of action? I think obviously not in the Brewer versus Downey case, because they succeeded in bringing the cause of action, and they succeeded in getting to the jury with other testimony.
One question, please.
Sure.
How long does the duty to maintain the record get under a spoliation tort?
In the case of 241.103 from the Texas Health and Safety Code, for the period of time charged, to 2 years or majority plus 2 years. In the case of physicians, the AMA and the Texas Medical Association say, look to the statute of limitations. Maintain the records for 2 years, or in the case of minors, beyond that time. For other types of records, financial records, I think it would be a reasonable person standard. It would depend upon the standards in the industry. And you would then get into issues such as Mr. McGarry's case, where this court made a determination that incident reports aren't medical records, and the hospital immediately formulated a standard that, oh, we're going to destroy them after 6 months.
Okay.
That would go into the inquiry.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Three or four points I'd like to cover. One for Ms. Wilkins concerning the whether or not the incident reports were medical records. She has, I believe, attached to the appendix of her brief the Texas Administrative Code, which defines what is a medical record for the purposes of the statute and does not include these incident reports. Secondly, as far as Mr. McGarry's argument that, well, the courts don't have to give these instructions. Well, if it's raised by the evidence, courts are required to give instructions. If they don't, they can be reversed. The problem we have in the Malone case was that there was no objection to the charge for the failure to give the presumptive instruction, and therefore it wasn't raised on appeal. In fact, there's evidence that Ms. Wilkins pointed out in her brief that the jury heard that what was on this incident report was transposed or taken and put on the medical records themselves. So what was on the incident report was on the medical records. Another thing Mr. McGarry said was, well, the jury can ignore these instructions. Well, if that is a basis for rejecting the instruction and going to an independent tort, then the whole charge system is going to have to be revamped by this court, because that could be said to be the case for any instruction given by the court. And no, on any of these instructions, we don't necessarily have the mechanism to find out if the jury is going to follow. We assume they do. We assume they follow their civic duty and follow the instructions that are given by the court. Now, one point that was raised by Justice Heck that I think is important, particularly with respect to the scenario that Mr. McGarry is arguing, that is, you've got to prove a case in the case. And that is, most of these cases you try the medical malpractice case first, and then you go and show that you lost the case because you didn't have these records. Well, if you think about it, in the medical malpractice case, if you have the presumption You're going to go to the jury with the presumption that whatever there was bad for the defendant and was good for the plaintiff. And the jury will have rejected that presumption. If you then go to a second case where there's an independent tort, what different evidence do you have? How does it get any better? Why isn't the first case, if you have this presumption, why isn't that collateral estoppel?
What about the situation, as I understand it, Mr. McGarry's case, where because of the absence of the records, you cannot obtain the necessary expert testimony to get past a directed verdict?
Well, first off, I disagree. All the medical records in Mr. McGarry's case were present. In fact, there was testimony that whatever was on this incident report was taken by the nurse and put into the medical records. Second, as far as getting past the directed verdict, and I believe that was raised also, with this presumption, if you look at the H.E. Budd case, the way I read the case, it says that this presumption, if unrebutted, if it's unrebutted by the defendant, will get a plaintiff past a summary judgment, past a direct verdict, past a motion for new trial, and will, again, be artificial evidence to survive a sufficiency challenge on appeal in this court or the courts below.
Did the H.E.B. case, I'm not familiar with it, did it involve expert testimony?
It actually involved an onion that was lost. And it was a plea of privilege, and they lost the onion, they stored the onion afterwards, and it did not involve Justice Abbott expert testimony. But they talked about how that this presumption, if it's unrebutted, would, again, get them in that case past the plea of privilege, old plea of privilege proceedings that we had at that particular time. Again, we think the presumption is all that's needed. We don't think it ever gets any better than the presumption.
But if the third party destroys it,
If the third party destroys it, someone who is not the tortfeasor, obviously you have a different situation. And I think, again, you have to look at, first off, was there any duty on the part of the third party?
And if there was.
And if there was a duty, then I think you get to the second point was, well, did the destructions of the record prevent the plaintiff from prevailing in the case? And again, you get back to the same argument regarding speculative nature. How do you ever get past it?
But if it's a third party, you wouldn't get an obstruction case.
No, but we still have the question of whether or not it prevented the plaintiff from prevailing against the other person who's not a party.
Assume it did. Get the very best case scenario.
In the very best case scenario, assuming that the third party spoliator owed a duty to the plaintiff.
Well, no. Through the state, there is a requirement. A record somewhere that record has to be kept.
Well, the other thing, as far as the state statute in the hospital, one of the things that hadn't been pointed out is that statute was enacted in 1989. The underlying medical malpractice case was filed in 1988. The ABA canons that we're talking about, the version I saw was 1991, 3 years after the underlying lawsuit had been filed.
But I'm just interested in following out Judge Heck's question. When, if ever, can a third party's fault, accident, intent, how would your presumption system ever benefit?
System would not work with respect to a third party. I agree with the court on that. But you still have the problem even going against a third party as far as the speculative nature and whether or not this court is going to allow those types of suits in the court, in the Kramer case and other cases, have said if it's too speculative, we're not going to allow it.
Any other questions?
I have one question. In the case about the child that was allegedly injured at birth, and let's assume that there's intentional destruction, there's a statutory duty to keep the document, what is the presumption such that the expert can make an opinion? What do you presume that the doctor did what?
You presume, again, in the Brewer versus Dowling case, you presume that the evidence that has been reflected on the medical records would have been detrimental to the part of the defendant.
But it has to be more specific for an expert to then come in and say...
I'm not sure an expert has to necessarily rely on presumption, because I think that stretches what I think it allows. If you look at these presumption cases, it allows, again, creates this artificial evidence and allows the attorney to argue that, in fact, it would have shown that the...
You're not understanding. The expert can't get up and testify. In my opinion, this doctor breached the duty of care because he or she failed to do X. Now, unless you presume that he or she failed to do X, the expert has nothing on which to base their opinion. How do you get over that hurdle?
Well,
in the presumption case.
Well, again, going back to the HEB case, the courts have said that it will create the necessary evidence, this presumption will, to get a party to a jury.
So the trial court can tell the expert that you may assume that the doctor used tongs, that you may assume what facts are given to the expert such that they can formulate an opinion that's the breach of duty by the doctor.
Okay. Well, first off, I'm not so sure, I don't think it's my opinion that the expert necessarily opines on the presumption. Because if you have the expert opining on the presumption, then I think we get into a myriad of other problems in Robinson and Daubert and all these things as far as what an expert may base his or her opinions on, how reliable is it, things like that, and I don't think we can do that.
Was the presumption that the doctor, that the records would show the doctor breached the standard of care and that was proximate cause of the injury?
I think there is a presumption that is negative, and that's a presumption that can be argued by counsel to the jury. I don't think it's something that the expert can necessarily base his opinion on because I don't think it meets the other bases that experts can rely on.
Let me ask you another way. In a case where you've got intentional spoliation and you've got an instruction to the jury, do you need expert testimony to support the jury's verdict finding there was proximate cause, there was negligence or proximate cause, and damage?
I would think under the HEB case, probably not.
In a malpractice case?
In a malpractice case, it says it suffices as evidence to get you to the jury.
You wouldn't even need an expert.
No.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the combined consolidated argument, and we'll take another brief recess.
All right.